Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. We hear from scholar, author, and political analyst Rahul Mahajan first about the death of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi in Iraq. Then Marjorie Cohn joins us to talk about war crimes, the Haditha massacre, and the first U.S. military officer to refuse duty in Iraq. Rahul Mahajan is publisher of the blog Empire Notes and author of The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism in 2002, and Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond in 2003. Rahul Mahajan, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Nice to be with you.
First on al-Zarqawi, you have been skeptical about U.S. military reports and media coverage about him. What are your thoughts about what we are learning as the story of his death unfolds?
I'll accept that he is dead. I really don't think that the U.S. military and the Bush administration would have gone to all these lengths had they not actually killed him. And I think that the administration for once is being somewhat sensible in what it says, which is it is trying to make it clear that there's no way of knowing what effect this will have on the situation in Iraq. I mean, obviously, one of the things they would like is to see Zarqawi's organization start tearing itself apart in internecine warfare. One thing that they haven't mentioned is that since Zarqawi and his organization concentrated so much on targeting Shiites and on fomenting intersectarian warfare, the death of Zarqawi, even if it leads to problems for his organization, might actually help the rest of the insurgency to unify once a thorn in their side has been removed.
We did hear from Italian journalist Loretta Napoleoni on Democracy Now. She's an expert on al-Zarqawi and has written about him. And she actually did mention that the U.S. had played a significant role in creating his image in terms of perhaps even going so far as to lead to the recruitment of people for Zarqawi's force.
The way to understand this is basically this. Zarqawi existed. Zarqawi had the agenda that has been described numerous times in the mainstream and other media. But early on, what I can only describe as just undiluted foolishness, the U.S. military and the Bush administration seized on Zarqawi as being a chance to present a particularly, sort of evil face of the insurgency, or that's how they saw it. And so there was a great deal of exaggeration of his role. Sometimes Zarqawi wanted events attributed to him that he actually was not involved in. In particular, the first assault on Fallujah in April 2004, Zarqawi did a lot to try to take credit for it. The United States basically helped him to do that. There's no real indication that he was seriously involved in any way. And that particular assault was really what made the insurgency look heroic in Iraq and throughout the Arab world. So it's been documented now that over and over again, the U.S. military has actually helped Zarqawi in his propaganda campaigns, and that has had the effect, which I don't think they intended, but which was incredibly obvious if you think about their policy, of helping to recruit for Zarqawi. Right now in Iraq, the situation is just unbelievably precarious, both in general terms and for the United States. And, I mean, I think we can't forget that other story, the Haditha massacre, which has, on the one hand, it's not a surprise to Iraqis in any way, and it doesn't really necessarily mean all that much because their attitude is basically they kill Iraqi civilians every day. That's what the occupation is, and this is, to them, not very much different. But it has changed the political situation. The new prime minister, al-Maliki, has, on the one hand, has promised to free 2,500 detainees, some of whom have been held up for more than a year without being charged with any kind of crime, and on the other hand, has said explicitly that Haditha is standard operating procedure, is basically the day-to-day experience of the occupation. So the United States is dealing with an incredibly precarious situation. They still have a bunch of factions that none of whom they want to induce to disaffection, and so they have a lot of balancing still to do.
Tell us about the impact overall of what the U.S. forces did in Fallujah as it relates to people like Zarqawi and the success of these hardline soldiers, if you will.
That first assault on Fallujah is tremendously important and has been sort of forgotten in the context of the second assault. One thing was that it was quite obviously and openly a collective punishment of the town for harboring a handful of people who had been involved in the desecration of the corpses of Blackwater security mercenaries. So everyone, you know, Shia and Sunni alike, leaving out only the Kurds, saw it as just a tremendously, malignantly unjust and was opposed to it. And that was the time when you saw some talk about Shia Sunni unity, which of course quickly petered out. It was also seen as a victory for the insurgency because the U.S. stopped short of taking the city and basically made it into the Islamic Republic of Fallujah. And so what it did was that although Zarqawi was not really involved in that effort, it created an extremely militant, radicalized recruiting environment for Zarqawi and others, but Zarqawi probably took the most advantage of it. And so that assault and then the period of waiting between the April assault and waiting for the U.S. elections to be over so they could attack Fallujah again was critical in the evolution of the insurgency and, unfortunately, in its evolution towards the rather malignant sectarian terrorist form that much of it has taken.
Let's talk about the new Iraqi government's take on the death of al-Zarqawi. We heard the new Iraqi ambassador to the U.S. calling him Hitler.
Well, you know, the Zarqawi is Hitler thing, I mean, I guess it's gratifying to see that we've exported our political forms to Iraq to the degree that they have developed an utterly inane public discourse. I mean, I think that one doesn't have to defend anything about Zarqawi or refrain from condemning him in order to point out that the comparison with Hitler is just completely idiotic. And in the Iraqi context, I don't even know what it's supposed to signify for people. In general, I think there has been, in the last few months in particular, more of a convergence between what authority figures in Iraq say and seem to want and what the United States seems to want. And I think it's Iraqis hewing closer to the U.S. line. I mean, we need to understand that right from the beginning, from the first elections and certainly after the December elections, this is not a puppet government selected by the United States. It was Ayatollah Sistani who won them the right to elections. Although the U.S. tried to manipulate them, its attempts were a miserable failure, and the people who have been elected are rather hostile to the United States, but they're also extremely pragmatic as well as being corrupt and susceptible to influence. And what happened lately, I think, is that it's really been the explosion of intersectarian violence beyond any kind of seemingly containable limit that has kind of forced convergence in a lot of the rhetoric that's going on. Basically, the only chance for the United States in Iraq is to be seen as a less severe enemy of people than Zarqawi, a less severe enemy of the Sunnis and the Shia militias, a less severe enemy of the Shia militias and the Sunni insurgency, and so on. To the degree it's successful in that, you see a convergence in the way that people talk about Iraq.
Rahul Mahajan, we've been talking recently with Yanar Mohammed of the Organization for Women's Freedom in Iraq and with Madre Yifat Suskind of that organization. And apparently their reports are that conditions are dire in Iraq for women. They spoke about hundreds of thousands of people that have become internal refugees. We're hearing very little about this in the press, but some of the problem appears to be, you know, the issue of death squads and the violent deaths that are occurring in the cities in Baghdad and other places. Some of this, though, is also about the implementation of Sharia law and the ongoing civil war.
I mean, there's internal ethnic cleansing going on in Iraq in a significant way. And there's also this sort of sectarian cleansing. There's just religious cleansing in terms of just kicking out people who don't want to live under extreme forms of Sharia law. Iraq has internally displaced refugees from the major U.S. assaults, especially the second assault on Fallujah, but also from assaults on Tal Afar and other places, and it has internally displaced refugees as a result of the Iraqi-driven sectarian ethnic cleansing. Authority in Iraq, although nominally with the central government and nominally with the U.S. military in some ways, in practice and day-to-day has devolved to a series of local authorities who are judged in terms of the occupation. They're judged not by their political positions in general, but only by their willingness to play ball with the occupation. So in the South, for example, right from the beginning, the British have run things basically by making a corrupt deal with the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq and similar kinds of forces, allowing them to run things, allowing them to impose whatever laws they want, even though their views in Basra, which was a somewhat cosmopolitan city, are really in the minority. It's gotten to the point now where they're actually trying to keep women from having jobs and sometimes even from driving, and imposing a sort of Saudi-style Sharia law on Basra, and the occupiers who are supposedly there to liberate really only judge any of this in terms of, are these guys with us or against us, much as with, for example, the recent U.S. intervention in Somalia, where it intervened to arm some Islamist warlords against other Islamist warlords simply on the basis of, you know, who's willing to be on our side.
Rahul Mahajan, thanks so much for joining us to talk about Iraq again, and I look forward to your reports on where we're headed in the near future.
It was great to be with you, Dori.
Rahul Mahajan has been to Iraq twice. He reported from Fallujah during the siege in April 2004. He has been published widely, including in USA Today, Newsday, The Baltimore Sun, The Times of India, and The Jordan Times. You will find his work online at empirenotes.org. Rahul Mahajan is author of The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism, and Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. You're listening to Talk Nation Radio. We turn now to the president-elect of the National Lawyers Guild, Marjorie Cohn. Her weekly columns for truthout.org have been on the Haditha massacre and U.S. Army First Lieutenant Aaron Watada, who is the first officer to publicly state his refusal to go to Iraq. I asked Marjorie Cohn to talk about some of the possible consequences if various kinds of officials investigating the Haditha massacre prove that the U.S. committed war crimes there.
I think that Marines that were directly involved will likely be charged, perhaps with murder, but I don't think that the charges are going to go very high up the chain of command, and I don't think we're going to see anyone prosecuted for war crimes under the U.S. War Crimes Act. People who commit war crimes can be punished by life in prison or even the death penalty if the victim dies. And under the doctrine of command responsibility, a commander can be held liable if he knew or should have known his inferiors were committing war crimes and he failed to stop or prevent it. But who files war crimes? Who files criminal charges against people for war crimes? And war crimes are considered to be grave breaches of the Geneva Convention. Willful killing would be the one. Also, torture and inhuman treatment are considered war crimes as well. Alberto Gonzalez, the Attorney General, is the one who would file the criminal charges. Is he going to charge Bush or Cheney or Rumsfeld with war crimes? Is he going to charge anyone with war crimes, including Marines who were involved in this? I think the answer is no. And there won't be any prosecutions in the International Criminal Court because Bush has taken our signature off of the International Criminal Court statute and then blackmailed about 100 small countries into agreeing not to turn our people over to the International Criminal Court to be tried for war crimes and crimes against humanity and genocide. So I don't think there will be any international prosecutions. There could be prosecutions under the principle of universal jurisdiction. For example, in Belgium and Germany, there were charges brought, and in fact there are charges pending in Canada as well against Bush and company for war crimes. And yet the U.S. succeeded in Belgium and succeeded in Germany in blackmailing the establishment there into dropping those prosecutions. In the case of Belgium, in changing its universal jurisdiction statute, and the case in Canada is still pending. So I think it's likely we will see perhaps some homicide prosecutions against a few Marines. There may be some commanders, staff sergeants, who are charged with lesser crimes for covering up the Haditha massacre, but I do not foresee the liability traveling up the chain of command very far, and I do not foresee any prosecutions under the War Crimes Act.
Even as the story about Haditha has been in the news, we've had another story developing that you've been involved in, Marjorie, that of U.S. Army First Lieutenant Aaron Watada, the officer who refused his orders to go to Iraq. You write about this in your June 8th editorial in truthout.org. Talk about what the implications are in terms of the violations of uniform codes of military justice.
The Uniform Code of Military Justice, specifically Articles 90 through 92, set forth the duty of military personnel to obey lawful commands. The Nuremberg Principles, which come from the Nuremberg Tribunal, which have been incorporated through executive orders into U.S. law, so they're part of our federal law, the Nuremberg Principles provide that all military personnel have an obligation not to obey illegal orders. And in fact, the Army Field Manual, Section 2710, Section 609, and the Uniform Code of Military Justice, Article 92, both incorporate this principle from Nuremberg. Specifically, Article 92 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice says a general order or regulation is lawful unless it is contrary to the Constitution, the law of the United States, etc.
What does that mean in terms of world courts?
Well, again, the World Court is the International Criminal Court, and it will not have jurisdiction over U.S. soldiers or leaders, because Bush has not only refused to send it to the Senate for ratification, but actually unsigned it, taken our signature off of it. Universal jurisdiction is a principle that was used by Israel to prosecute, convict, and execute Adolf Eichmann for his crimes during the Holocaust. Even though none of those crimes happened in Israel, there is a principle called universal jurisdiction, which is very well established in our law, and that is that there are certain crimes that are so serious, such as war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, that any country who gets jurisdiction over the national of another country can prosecute. And so it may be that some countries prosecute some of our leaders under this principle of universal jurisdiction. But once again, most of the countries in the world are terrified of the U.S. government and retaliation by the United States. So I don't foresee, it may be that some prosecutions are brought, it may be that some civil suits are brought, but I don't foresee any effective prosecution where anyone can actually be held liable. Although, you know, there was a real victory in the case of Salvadoran general in the Romagosa case here in the United States. It was a civil case brought under the Alien Tort Claims Act and the Torture Victim Protection Act, where a civil jury actually found liability on the basis of command responsibility of a Salvadoran general, and they got jurisdiction over him, but they didn't actually, I don't know that they've ever collected the money, but that was a real victory. So we might see those things. I don't think we're going to see criminal prosecutions in this country based upon that. Now, this illegal orders defense, you know, I was just following orders defense, was used by Lieutenant William Calley for his role in the My Lai massacre. He was prosecuted during the Vietnam War. And by the way, that massacre was also covered up for, I believe, about a year, including Colin Powell, who helped cover it up, until Seymour Hersh from The New Yorker broke the story. In that particular case, about 400 elderly men, women, and children were killed, were just massacred by U.S. soldiers. There was a heroic soldier who tried to stop it in a helicopter. But Lieutenant William Calley was kind of the scapegoat. He was the highest officer who was called to account for it. The higher-ups were never brought to justice. And he raised the defense of, I was just following orders, which is a defense that some of the Nazis raised at Nuremberg, and it did not fly because of this specific provision in our law, in our military law, that obeying an unlawful order is not a defense. That if you had a moral choice, if you had an opportunity to figure out that this was an illegal order, then you had a duty to disobey it. Now, of course, that doesn't take into account the reality that if you refuse to obey it, you could be killed on the spot, but it is still a principle that is well enshrined in our law.
Talk about Aaron Watada and how he has interpreted his responsibility in terms of the military's Uniform Code of Justice.
Yes, he is the first officer to publicly state his refusal to obey an order to deploy to Iraq. He held a press conference in Tacoma, Washington, and I was present there. He asked me to come speak about the legality of the war. And he said at that press conference that the war in Iraq is, in fact, illegal. It is my obligation and my duty to refuse any orders to participate in this war. And then he said, an order to take part in an illegal war is unlawful in itself, so my obligation is not to follow the order to go to Iraq. Now, he had signed up for the Army 3 years ago, and he said that he had doubts about the legality of the war in Iraq, but he gave Bush the benefit of the doubt, but that he has learned over the last 3 years, he actually called it deception and manipulation and willful misconduct by the highest levels of my chain of command. And then he said there is no greater betrayal to the American people than the Iraq war, and that he best serves his soldiers by speaking out against unlawful orders of the highest levels of my chain of command and making sure our leaders are held accountable. And he understands he may be facing court-martial and imprisonment for what he's doing. The Army has been very recalcitrant about letting him out voluntarily. He's been trying for several months to get out without a big fuss, and they're holding firm, and when he does not show up to board the plane, he will, in all likelihood, be arrested and court-martialed.
Let's take a look at the press. I'm looking at the latest newsletter from Dar Jamail. We spoke with him last week. He's talking about Haditha in terms of propaganda and then the responsibility that falls on the press when events like Haditha are not well covered and the consequences are dire in terms of these events continuing in Iraq.
Keep in mind that the Haditha massacre took place on November 19th of last year. The next day, the U.S. Marine Corps issued a statement saying that U.S. Marine and 15 civilians were killed by a roadside bomb as opposed to being executed, which is what the evidence all shows now. And a second Marine version said, well, these victims were killed inadvertently in a running gun battle with the insurgents. And it wasn't until Time magazine brought them a videotape from an independent journalist and it's the results of its investigation that the U.S. military started investigating in earnest. And in fact, there is evidence that the U.S. military covered it up. Now, we have thought that Time magazine was the first, in March, mid-March, was the first media outlet to break this story. But in fact, Dar Jamal, in his article that came out in Truth Out, said that Al Jazeera had the entire Haditha story as soon as it occurred, and they shared it with Western and other media outlets. And then 2 days after the massacre, Dar Jamal, Iraq.com, posted it. And yet the New York Times, on that same day, just parroted the Marine Corps' false story that these civilians were killed when a roadside bomb exploded. He mentions the an alleged massacre at Ishaki on March 15, 2006. And on June the 1st, BBC released a story. And in that story, they actually referred to, well, the Associated Press said that a video shot by one of the AP cameramen and broadcast by the BBC showed some bodies, including seven children, with deep head wounds that could have been caused by bullets or shrapnel. So another massacre. And BBC didn't release that story until all this interest in Haditha was in the media. And so then immediately after that, the U.S. military came out and exonerated the Marines for the Ishaki massacre, evidently having investigated it before because they couldn't just do it in one day. and quickly exonerating them for damage control because they're dealing with the Haditha massacre. And in fact, a senior defense official is quoted in a Los Angeles Times article as saying nothing suggests anything happened close to Haditha, even though 11 civilians were evidently shot in cold blood in Ishaki. The Pentagon tried to cover that up. They said the civilians were killed in a crossfire between American forces and al-Zarqawi. And, of course, now that al-Zarqawi is dead, they're not going to be able to blame anything else on him. Here you have another situation where a man was killed in Hamandija on April 26th. And, again, an attempt at a cover-up by the Marines, first offering bribes. The family of this man who was killed was offered bribes to support the Marines' version of the killing and saying that, you know, this really was not, he had a shovel in his hand, he was about to bury an improvised explosive device, whereas in fact he was disabled. They pulled him out of his house and they executed, and then they planted an assault rifle and a shovel near him. So what the Marines are doing is are quickly arresting, I don't know, about 7 Marines, putting them in prison and saying we're going to prosecute this to the full letter of the law as if just one death. Meanwhile, refusing to admit that there was any kind of wrongdoing in Hamandija, and then spending a few months investigating Haditha to see how they can do damage control there.
And you've been looking at what you call controlling the beast.
But, you know, on Saturday, in an annual security conference, Donald Rumsfeld said, "We don't intend to occupy Iraq for any period of time. Our troops would like to go home, and they will go home." And Bush said, "You know, we're going to send the troops home as soon as things are stable in Iraq. We want to get those troops home." Well, you know, those are great words, but then you look at what the U.S. is doing as opposed to what it's saying. First of all, it's building a huge embassy in Baghdad that occupies a space two-thirds the area of the National Mall in Washington, D.C. It will have 21 buildings that will house over 8,000 government officials, a huge pool, a gym, a theater, a beauty salon, a school, and 6 apartment buildings. Huge embassy in Baghdad. Then you look at the construction of the largest foreign military base built since Vietnam, Camp Anaconda, near Balad. That is home to 20,000 soldiers, thousands of mercenaries. The aircraft runway is the second busiest in the world. You know, it does not look like we're going to be leaving anytime soon. There are between 6 and 14 more permanent U.S. military bases being built in Iraq. That says to me that they're lying about their intention to get out of Iraq. I quoted Tom Friedman, one of the cheerleaders for the Iraq War. Some call him a liberal, and I call him a neocon. In March of 1999, he wrote an article in the New York Times, and this is what Tom Friedman wrote. "For globalism to work, America can't be afraid to act like the almighty superpower that it is. The hidden hand of the market will never work without a hidden fist. McDonald's cannot flourish without McDonnell Douglas, the designer of the F-15, and the hidden fist that keeps the world safe for Silicon Valley's technologies is called the United States Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps." So we have what Eisenhower warned us about, and that is the military-industrial complex. And it is alive and well in Iraq. When you see that since Bush took over, oil companies have earned record profits. Dick Cheney's Halliburton has landed many of the juiciest contracts in Iraq. And new Iraqi laws that U.S. Ambassador Paul Bremer put in place lock in significant advantages for U.S. corporations in Iraq, including corporate access to and control of Iraq's oil.
Marjorie Cohn, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Dory.
Marjorie Cohn is president of the National Lawyers Guild, NLG.org. You can read her reports online at truthout.org, where she has a weekly editorial column. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dory Smith. Talk Nation is produced in the studios of WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut in Stores, Connecticut, whus.org. And TalkNation.org or TalkNationRadio.org to locate transcripts and our online discussion pages through the new cafe.